You're listening to the Sisters in Loss podcast, a faith-based podcast that spotlights Black women who replace silence with storytelling around pregnancy and infant loss and infertility. Black women experience miscarriage and stillbirth 4 to 5 times more likely than white women, according to the NIH and CDC. Whether you've experienced a miscarriage, infant loss, stillbirth, are trying to conceive, or have an infertility diagnosis, you will learn about resources and strategies to heal, gain clarity, peace, hope, and find an empowering path forward after loss. I'm your host, Erica M. McAfee, and you will hear me interview sisters in loss who have healed from such a painful and traumatic experience by sharing their testimonies and stories to inspire and help others turn their pain into their purpose. Now let's get started. All right. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me, Erica.
Absolutely. I would love for you to share a little bit about yourself and what you do.
Hi, everybody. My name's Jessica, and I am coming to you from the center of England in a city called Coventry. And I run a charity called Hannah's House. And it was born after the death of my second daughter. But that's really kind of halfway through the story. So I think I'll take a little step back and tell you everything that's happened to us. So I was married in 2012. And my brother-in-law actually is married to a beautiful American lady. So we went on our honeymoon. We delayed it for a year. And we traveled the East Coast of America, ending up in New York. So I was sitting in JFK in July 2013. I felt a little bit funny, but we'd had a great 3 weeks. I thought maybe my body was just saying, you've drank too much, you've eaten too much. And I was like, okay. We got on the plane, got home, and my husband was working in a different city at the time. So he'd left, and I just wasn't feeling right. So I rang my boss, said I wasn't coming in, went to the doctor. And she said, oh, well, you know, when was your last period? And I said, it's a good question. So I had a look, and I was a little bit late. and she did a pregnancy test. But I had also started really bleeding really heavily. So I just had the start of miscarriage. So really, before we'd thought about starting a family, it was over. And that was that, really. She just sent me on my way out of the GP surgery. I just went home. My husband was gone, and I rang my pastor, actually, and she prayed with me on the phone and kind of just put it to bed, really. Just a bit matter of fact about it and carried on. And then they said, you know, you don't have to wait. You can just start trying again. So we did a month in and a month out. And I know some of your listeners will know that feeling of, you know, every month it doesn't happen. Gets, you know, your hope goes down and down and down. And I've realized now, in the grand scheme of things, that 6 months is not a long time. It really isn't at all. But it felt like an absolute age at the time. And so we found out we were having another baby, and everything went wonderful. You know, there were a few circumstances around that. My father-in-law died. My paternal grandma died whilst I was pregnant. You know, she was born, my beautiful Hannah came. She flew into the world. They literally just caught her before she threw off the end of the bed. And that is how she lives her life. She is a hurricane. She's a force to be reckoned with. And we love her dearly. And so we were happy being a family of three, and we thought we'd have another baby. And thinking about how long it took us last time, I was, you know, ready for the long haul. Lo and behold, 2 weeks later, I was pregnant again. and everything was fine. And I actually didn't feel very well. Like I had a little bit of sickness with Hannah, but I think that's really about the amount of food that I ate. But I was feeling quite poorly. And I didn't think anything of it, just kind of kept going on. I had an 18-month old to look after. I was back at work. I think we get a little bit longer for our maternity leave than you do in the US. So I think I just had just under a year, and I was back at work. And we went for our 12-week scan, so our early scan, and the sonographer said that she couldn't see what she wanted to see with baby. So, and I now realise that when the NHS, the people that run our healthcare, give you a cup of tea, things are not good. So she took us into another room and gave us a cup of tea and said she was going to refer us to fetal medicine. But we had to wait. It's the longest week. Had to wait a whole week before we went to see our consultant, a lady who has become a really good friend who walked a long walk with us. And she went through everything. She scanned the baby from top to bottom. We were in there for like near 2.5 hours. And she diagnosed Amelia with anencephaly and spina bifida. And they're both neural tube defects. So she had the substantial part of her skull missing. They lovingly call as not compatible with life. So it was suggested we had termination. And really, in that instant when everything was whirling in my head, it was the one thing I knew that I couldn't do. And my husband was really worried about what was going to happen to me. You know, they give you all of these facts, you know, about the terrible things that could happen. So we went away. We went back a couple of days later and we said, no, we continue with the pregnancy. And they said, okay, well, we don't expect her to survive past 18 weeks. And then she did. And they said, we don't expect her to survive past 24 weeks. And she did. And then we made a plan for her birth. And they said, well, we really don't expect her to live or to survive birth. And she did. She was my baby. She survived. And we had her for 57 wonderful minutes. We got to love her. And she got to meet both her grandmas. A few years later, someone said to me, you know, she knew nothing but love in this world. In this world that is so, you know, falling apart right now and decaying and just going the wrong way, she knew nothing but love. And so many wonderful things have come from her life. So many policies and changes around the hospital, which I, you know, we don't need to go into now. But yeah, she was an absolute blessing. And I, you know, it was really my heart's cry. The hardest thing I have ever done in my 41 years is leave that hospital without her. I have to leave her there. You know, it was so tough. You know, my heart. And I came home and my pastor had dropped some food off. So she was here with my mom and Hannah, who was there. She was just two. And so I really felt that was, you know, my natural mother and my spiritual mother were here waiting for us. And after I put Hannah to bed, and it just dissolved into the floor. And it was my heart's cry that this pain wouldn't be in vain. And so I started to try and do a few things to look at what bereavement support we could do. And it was really just like walking through treacle. It was so hard. I just kept trying and it just wasn't happening. And, you know, I kept trying to do this and this hurdle. And then I was like, okay. And then later, so we're in 2017 now. So we thought we would try for another baby. We went on holiday, went to Turkey with some friends. I had a great time when I came back and I was pregnant. And I had another very early miscarriage. And I was really quite distraught about it. You know, I was broken. Yeah, all the things that I thought I had dealt with from Amelia dying earlier in the year, I kind of just unraveled again. And so we came into 2018 and we tried again and we had another miscarriage. And at that point, I think I just shut down. And I actually said to my, I was at work and my boss said, Jessica, okay. I said, oh, I had a miscarriage last week and kind of just carried on doing my job. But she was like, okay, should you be here? How can I help you? How can I support you? But I'm fine. Obviously was not fine, I maintained that was strong. But I mean, shortly after that, I did get pregnant again with my eldest son, at which point I think I was just a ball of hormones and anxiety and all of these things that I hadn't processed. So I was still in touch with my bereavement midwife who'd supported us through Amelia's pregnancy. And I said, well, what can I do? Where can I go to get help? And she's like, well, don't have anything. So I was like, right. And so we set up the pregnancy after loss group. It's called Pregnancy with Hope. And working with the chaplains and bereavement midwives at the hospital. We met once a month and I sat there and shared our story. I mean, there's so much power in sharing your story. And you know, that's the basis of these podcasts, about the power and showing your scars and showing your vulnerability to other people. And so, yeah, that was good. And then my eldest son was born. He's 4 now, and he is just, I mean, in my life plan, I had a vision of 2 girls. That's all I ever wanted. I never wanted boys, but he is just so loving. He's just the cutest thing. And I had a sticker on. I had a Chase sticker with a pirate hat. He gave that to me. He saved it. He's been at his grandma's, so I just picked him up today. He said, "I saved this for you, mummy." He's so loving. And he's really what we needed. So that was, he was born at end of 2018, 2019, going back to work, still trying to do some things, you know, still running the pregnancy after group. So then we had the parenting after last group, the parenting with Hope. It was just good. And then the pandemic hit and everything shut down. So we were at home, just, you know, the 4 of us being, as that's what we did. And Hannah said to me, "Mommy, I wish Amelia was here to play with us." And the bottom fell out of my world, Erica. You know, I just thought, the one thing that I would wanted to be able to give her, a sister to play with, is the one thing I could give her. So I just excused myself from the table and I came upstairs. And again, I just collapsed on the floor, and all the things that I hadn't dealt with, all of the loss, all of the anger, just unraveled itself. And I really just cried some more. And, you know, I don't believe that things happen by chance, but, you know, a few hours later, I got a phone call from a friend who runs a bereavement charity in the area. And she said, "Jess, I've got 12 hours pro bono counselling. When I was at my stage in your loss, I would really have appreciated that." In no uncertain terms, I told her where to go. I didn't need any help. Hung up the phone, and the bedroom door cracked open. My husband put his head around. He said, "Who are you talking to like that?" I was like, "Oh, well, Charlotte rang and she said this, and she thinks I need help and I don't need help." And he said, "Babe, you sure you don't want to give her a call back? You might, maybe." I was like, "No." And so the next morning I woke up and I said, "You know, I think I might call it back." So I called it back. And that was really the beginning of how I got to where we are now. Those 12 hours of, you know, 12 weeks during the lockdown, being at home and having time, I wasn't able to escape from those feelings, or I had to deal with them. And so, yeah, she was amazing. And we spent the time, we unpicked everything, we dealt with the anger, we dealt with the unresolved grief, we dealt with the miscarriages that I had just brushed under the carpet, we dealt with me not being able to give my daughter what she wanted, you know, my vision of having, how my children look, what my family look like, that not coming how I planned, all of those things. And she suggested at the end of it that she said, "Do you know, I think you'd make a really good counsellor." I said, "Are you sure?" She said, "Yeah, you know, have a think about it." And, you know, in the next 2 weeks, 2 other people said it to me, and I was like, "Well, I'm going to take that." So I did my entry-level counselling qualification. And so we were still doing the groups and still going. And then it was early 21. And I went back and I was doing some studying. I went back to Bible college. And I was actually, because we were still online, we still weren't being allowed to be in college. And it was my first lecture of the day. And I had this email that pinged and it popped up on my screen. I was like, "Oh, let me just have a quick look," in the middle of my lecture. And it was from the Charities Commission to say that we had got the charitable status that we wanted for Hannah's house. We were official. And so, you know, in this story of great loss, everything happened in sequence. And so I'm now at 2021. I have dealt with my life, you know, all of the pain and the anger. And I have these 2 beautiful children. And I turned 40 in March 21. I said to my husband, I said, "Do you know, this 4th child is not materialized, it's not happening, it's not coming." I said, "You know, I'm 40 now. Let's just call it quits. Let's just leave it, you know." And he said, "If that's all you want to do, babe, then that's what we'll do. However, as I said that, I was already pregnant. So my little blessing, my 40th birthday present, I think I walked around for the whole pregnancy saying, I'm 40 and I'm pregnant. I'm 40, but I'm pregnant. But the pregnancy didn't quite go to plan, and he was perfectly small, but firm, but really small. So there was a problem with my placenta, that he wasn't getting what he needed. So I was in and out of hospital, and it was still COVID, and it was just, I think in September the 26th, I remember, I'd gone in for a scan. So my mum hadn't been very well, so she happened to be off work, so she came with me. And they said, Mrs. Weeks, you can't go home. She said, this baby's not getting what he needs. You've got to stay here. We're going to watch him. I was like, no, I'm not staying here. A, because when you stay in hospital, babies die. And B, because I've got two other children at home. So I kind of started freaking out. I was like, no, I'm just going to leave. And got in the lift. And like, I just let it all out. My mum was like, it's okay. Let's call out. Ring your husband. Call Andy. So I rang him and he said, we need to listen. So he was on site in another city. So he packed up all his tools. He said, I'm coming home. So I got home and I went to get my eldest from school just to tell her what happened. Because, you know, she's seen it all. She knows that when, you know, being pregnant doesn't always mean a baby comes home. And so I went into hospital and they were monitoring him 3 times a day. And because of what happened with the media, they took such good care of us. And it was going well. And then I tested positive for COVID. So they wouldn't let me leave. So I was literally, I felt like anyway, I was locked in a room, couldn't leave. I had this beautiful ensuite. I was there. But every time I had to go for a scan out of the hospital, I felt like, you know, I was like in all this, all of the PPE on the equipment. I hadn't been outside for days. And then eventually they decided that I could go home, but I had to come back in like the next week. And they said, we're going to deliver him next week. You're just going to stay here. We're going to watch him. I was like, okay. And at that point, I had just made peace and he was going to be okay. And we were standing and believing it was going to be fine. And, you know, but in my mind, I was like, if he's small, you know, surely the thing to do is just to keep him there, keep him inside so he can grow. They were like, we don't know what's causing him. Can't really see when he's in distress. So I went in, my mum came to look after the other two, and everything was going all right. I'd been there for 24 hours and my consultant came round and she was watching the monitor and she was watching, and her body language started to change. And then I was watching her watch the monitor, and then Andy was watching me, and then she got whiter and whiter and whiter, and she made a phone call. And then the head of obstetrics came and she said, right, we're going to deliver him. And I was just thinking, right, at today. And I said, okay. And she was like, when? I said, no. She said, no. I said, okay. But his heart rate was dipping and he was really struggling to get it back up. And so, you know, every time it went down, it was taking longer to come back up. So from her saying that to him being born was like maybe 55 minutes. I mean, he was in it, and he was so just under 2 pounds, so one kilogram. It was tiny, but he came out with it. He sounded like a little deer at first, and I had two midwives looking after me, and I said, was that him crying? She said, yeah, he came out with a mighty roar. And he was in hospital for 6 weeks. Yeah, he did so well. We came home, and he came home at like 4 pounds, so he was still like a tiny, tiny newborn. But so that was last year, and we have been going with the charity and pressing in and making those changes. So really my objectives for Hannah's House is really looking at the children within the family, because when Amelia died, Hannah was 2, and there was a lot of help around for us as parents, as adults, but we couldn't really find anything to help us help our children. And so that has been, you know, my big goal. We're just about, so we had our first fundraiser last year called Amelia's Birthday Party. We got the second one coming up on Tuesday. We're going to celebrate her 6th birthday. And it's just an opportunity to have a lot of fun and get dressed up. January is a bit miserable. We're just about to get a really cold snap here, so I don't know what it's like there, but it's dismal for people. So it's an opportunity to get people to get the best birthday outfit on, take a picture, share it on social media, and send us £2 per photo. We had a great time last year, and we're really excited about it happening on Tuesday again. And then my other key objective is looking after mums when they become pregnant again, helping them to relieve their anxieties. You know, shame dies when you share your story in a safe place. You know, knowing that you are supported, knowing that you're heard, knowing that people understand and know where you're coming from. So those are my two big goals, and we do those monthly. We have the Parenting with Hope group once a month, and then pregnant mums come to us when we need us. I mean, we're working with a mama at the minute who has had 23 miscarriages, Erica. I actually can't even. Can you comprehend getting up after that? Like after the sixth one, let alone the 23rd one. And I just found out again that she's having a cheap pregnant. And all as well, and I just feel like if we just help one person, then it's worth it. If one person is helped by me sharing my scars and sharing the story of what we went through, then it's worth it. But a lot of the things that we do with our families is resilience, helping them to deal with other people. You know, those at least you know you can get pregnant. At least you weren't far along. Oh, it wasn't meant to be. Everything happens for a reason. You know, and I you know, you must have heard some of those things. Yeah, but I mean, anything that starts with at least is not helpful to somebody who's lost a baby in any circumstances. And we get a lot now. Oh, you're a perfect family now. Yes, we are perfect. And yes, I am blessed. And yes, I'm so happy. But there is a little girl watching over me in heaven, and it doesn't take away from the fact that I would like her to be here. I mean, I know if she had the option to come back, or, you know, where she would stay, where any of us would stay. But yeah, she's still missing from me. She's still missing from me.
You're still missing, even with your rainbow babies that you've had. You
exactly.
Know, she's still a missing link with the family. But obviously, she's not here physically. She is here spiritually with you all, and I'm sure that I love the mission and what you're doing with Hannah's House. I think that we don't talk enough about what it looks like to parent children after loss and how we navigate their minds, especially where they are age-wise as well. Mm-hmm. Like, how do you explain that to kids?
Yeah.
How do they grow up knowing that they have siblings that aren't physically here? And how do we normalize death for kids, especially when a lot of parents want to protect kids around what death looks like? Mm-hmm. I love that this is what y'all are doing, especially helping other families and other parents as well, because I don't think we talk enough about how children grow up. It's actually one of my favorite books that I always recommend to clients is a book written by a mother who grew up. She was the rainbow baby. Her older sister died. And then she writes a book about her mom's perspective of not dealing with grief for all those years. So, you know, her mother was in her 80s when she wrote this book. This woman was in her 50s. And she was just like, you know, her mother parented her differently because she was the rainbow baby. And she never really talked about her older sister that passed away until she found photos of her older sister as a baby. And she was like, well, this isn't me. This is someone else. And then mom finally started to talk about it and finally started to grieve through it. So I always go back to that book because I just never think about, I don't think we think about the long-term effects it has on people if we don't deal with our own grief. So I'm so happy that you shared about your journey to really sitting down, really the pandemic. I think it did it for all of us when we had no choice but to sit still with our grief. And I mean, obviously we're still in it. It's not going anywhere. We're still in this this COVID state. And I know it is very much still very similar, like it is here in the States. But I would love for you to talk more about your grief journey, because I think that what you're doing with Hannah's House and doing the support groups is a part of your journey as well, because it's almost like I can attest to this because I do it when I do these interviews. It heals me to hear other people's stories, you know. And I always find similarities in how people express themselves and share their stories of how I felt in those moments of, you know, compounded grief where I just didn't know how I was going to get out of those situations. So I would love for you to share more about just how you've navigated your grief journey over the years, especially after going through this preterm pregnancy, preterm labor, preterm delivery, you know, NICU experience with your baby and then bringing your baby home. That's a whole nother set of grief that we don't even talk about.
Something different. Just to talk about a largest birth, it just happened so good. Like, I felt like it was happening to me, like I wasn't doing it, but afterwards I was like, I can't fault the hospital staff. They really look after me. So after I didn't get to hold him for like 12 hours, but they managed to get my hospital bed into intensive care. So I was actually eating tea. We love tea. I was drinking tea and eating toast when I, like, the first time I saw him, because they literally took him into another room, which is what they did with Amelia. So, I mean, you know, all of those things, all of those triggers came back. And then Andy went in, and very quickly the midwife came out and said, he's okay. He's all right. And so in the neonates into the NICU, and so they made sure that I was all right. And I think actually that I was not very well, that I was clotting. And the anaesthetist was like, we're going to give you something. It might make you feel a bit weird. And my husband stood there like, so it took them a little while to close me up. So he was born by C-section. And so after that, so it felt like days that I hadn't seen him. But anyway, Andy went home, made sure the other two were okay. And then I woke up, because obviously I was trying to express the milk. So I went down to neonates and I was there for a couple of hours and I started to feel really unwell. And the head of neonates said, right, you're going back to the ward. So she sent me back upstairs. And as I got into my room, I had a massive hemorrhage. I think they just knocked me out. They gave me some painkillers and I woke up 6 hours later. And I was like, oh, okay. And so, and then I was like, oh, I need to go see my baby. They're like, he's okay. We're going to get you something food. We're going to get you a shower. There was this underlying anxiety that I was really trying to push away. But, you know, I had dealt with a lot of things after Amelia had died in the miscarriages in that season of counselling. But I was, you know, having all of those feelings. And actually, it reminded me of, then when I'm going to go back and help mums, that actually it's not done and done. It's going to come back again. And so how do you deal with that? How do you deal with that when that anxiety comes back or that grief comes back that you thought you had dealt with at that time? And it's like a different version of what you felt the first time around. And so the resilience that we help our families to have is really born from what happened to me a year ago when I was laid in the hospital room for a week. I watched all of Netflix. I thought, I'll finish it. And in my bus, and she's like, are you home now? I was like, no, I'm kind of still in the hospital. She's like, what are you doing? Why are you working? I was like, well, what else am I going to do? Because I had no symptoms. I had no COVID symptoms. And I felt like a fraud because there were some really, really ill mums, Erica, in the hospital, like on the beds next to me. They were just like, they didn't know how it was going to pan out for them. But I was really, again, it gave me time to think about how I could use this experience to help others heal, but also to deal with the things. And I think once we had got home and I had that time, so I couldn't drive. For me, that's a real frustration because I'm a real control freak. I like to be able to go where I need to go without having to ask people for help. But I had to do that slowing down thing and just wait and be a little bit reliant on other people. And my friend and her husband just turned up on Saturday. And I don't know why I do it to myself. Like, everything just got to the point where I just burst into tears and all of the, you know, I felt like I didn't enjoy my last pregnancy because, you know, we were thinking about how it was going to pan out and what it was going to look like. And yeah, all of those things again that I was grieving for, like, and the neonates, it's like, it's, I don't know, it's like a different, it's like a vortex. You go in and, you know, especially when they're in, I mean, Elijah was in ITU for like 4 hours. He was always breathing by himself, but he was in the high dependency unit for maybe 3 weeks. And so it's dark and they try and keep it quiet, but it's really noisy and you spend all the time watching the heart monitor. I mean, I just used to watch it. And then, you know, he'd fall asleep and it would dip a bit. And I'd be like, oh. And then, you know, he would wiggle a bit. And he had his feeding tube out every day. My eldest son called him Prince Fire before he was born. I was like, but his middle name is Aiden, which means little fire. So we honored that in that way. But he, I mean, he had them on his toes. They're like, he got out of his nest today. Like, he can't move. Like, he had his feeding tube out, so his alarms were always going off. He was always pulling his heart rate monitor off. He just had it all. And so it was really just, it wasn't relaxing. And so when I got home, my son was, he's at nursery 3 days. He's not at school yet. I just sat like I had a tiny newborn and watched all the box sets and ate all the cake and expressed all the milk and just relaxed and took that time and reflected to get back what I thought I had been cheated from. And just held him. Do you know what? He is the most content out of the four. He's just so easygoing. And I wonder if it's because I just held him. Like, I wasn't in a rush to put him down. If I was doing stuff, I put him in a sling. I just wanted him to be... Like, you put him in the Moses basket. Like, he's... So he was 30 centimetres. I don't know what that is in inches. Like, he was tiny, tiny. And even when he was big, I mean, he's making up for it now. But people don't believe me when I say how small he was. But grief is a thing that looks different on everybody. But grief is a journey. It's not somewhere we're supposed to stay. And I really believe that there is hope to be found. There is hope to be found after your loss, whatever that looks like, or, you know, whatever your circumstances. But my time of healing, my time frame, and my journey is not yours. And so you might take some part of my story, of my healing, and think, yeah, this is good for me. This is my guidebook. And so it's just last year as a grief recovery method specialist. And again, it was another layer of healing that I thought we had dealt with. And just in the training, I was like, sometimes you're a little bit skeptical about how things actually work, but I was, yeah, absolutely in tears. All of this disenfranchised grief, undealt with grief coming up again, the things that I felt we'd been cheated of. And so that's something that we're going to start delivering to our families this year, is the one-to-one counselling, the one-to-one support, but also helping children with loss. Of course, they do that. It's my big heart's desire to be able to get families to a point where they can celebrate all of their children, whether they are here, whether they're not, without any anger, without any pain, without the stigma of what other people think. And if we can do that for one family, then that's amazing.
Love it, love it. So I would love for you to leave some encouraging words with our listeners, those who are navigating through grief and loss, and those who may be trying to conceive in this season.
I think that our tagline is Dare to Hope. It's just, it it can be painful to hope again, to let yourself think that your dream or your vision might actually happen. But I would just say, get back up again. And I think I spoke to a beautiful group last week in the north of England, and I said to them that you've already survived your very worst day. So if you think, you know, I can't survive it, you can. And to keep going, and to, you know, hope doesn't disappoint. You just keep believing and keep holding on to those good things. I think that is my, but also is to, you know, with time, is don't jump too far ahead. You know, don't think about, oh, what's going to be in 6 months, or, you know, just think about, you know, today. There's enough grace for today. And be kind to yourself, I think. And no is a perfectly good answer. You don't have to explain anything else, just no.
Yes. Well, thank you so much, Jessica, for sharing your story on the podcast. Where can we connect with you after this episode?
So you can find me on Instagram and Facebook at Hannah's House Cog, or you can find us on our website at hannahshouse.org.uk.
Perfect. Thank you so much for sharing your story. This has been such a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. For show notes, go to sistersinlaws.com. To stay connected with us and join the Sisters in Laws community and receive my weekly newsletter, please go to sistersinlaws.com/newsletter. That is sistersinlaws.com/newsletter. Please rate and review this episode, and I will talk to you next week.